Here we are again, another mass shooting in a school, this time in Florida. Children are dead. Politicians send their thoughts and prayers. Gun restriction advocates call for new laws. The NRA lobbies hard against them. Nothing changes. Rinse and repeat. It's all so predictable and so depressing. On the big show this week, we'll be looking at the one new factor, how the survivors of this shooting, high school children themselves, are taking on legislators and the gun lobby and demanding action. But for this podcast, we will replay a couple of interviews we recorded in the wake of other mass shooting tragedies. The first is with Adam Winkler, UCLA law professor and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, who we spoke to after Sandy Hook in 2012. He told us that there was a time when the NRA supported gun control, back when the Black Panthers were the ones passionately advocating gun rights. The Panthers determined that the government was either unwilling or unable to protect the lives of Black people, so they started publicly packing heat. Here's one of the movement's leaders, Huey Newton, from a documentary called The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, by filmmaker Stanley Nelson.
The California Penal Code, Section 12020 through 12027, and also the Second Amendment of the Constitution, guarantees the citizen a right to bear arms on public property.
Adam Winkler.
One of the surprising things I discovered in writing Gunfight was that when the Black Panthers started carrying their guns around in Oakland, California, in the late 1960s, it inspired a new wave of gun control laws. It was these laws that ironically sparked a backlash among rural white conservatives who were concerned that government was coming to get their guns next. The NRA mimicked many of the policy positions of the Black Panthers, who viewed guns not just as a matter of protection for the home, but something you should be able to have out on the street, and also protection against a hostile government that was tyrannical and disrespectful of people's rights.
There was an incident with a traffic stop. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale were sitting in a car, lightly armed.
They refused to give up their firearms. The police officer says, "What are you doing with those firearms?" But Huey Newton had gone to law school for a short time and had learned that in California it was lawful for him to be carrying loaded weapons as long as he carried them openly. In fact, the most dramatic incident was when the Black Panthers, 30 of them, showed up at the California State Capitol armed with loaded rifles, pistols, and shotgun and marched right into the legislative chamber while it was in session.
The State Assembly was in the midst of a heated debate when the young Negroes, armed with loaded rifles, shotguns, and pistols, marched into the Capitol.
In fact, they were debating a gun control law, and the Panthers were there not to do violence, but to protest this gun control law.
This episode freaked out conservative politicians, including the governor of California, who could not for the life of him imagine a situation where a lawful American would want to carry a loaded weapon in public.
I don't think that loaded guns is the way to solve a problem that should be solved between people of goodwill. And anyone who would approve of this kind of demonstration must be out of their mind.
What was the name of that governor?
That was Ronald Reagan, who would go on to become the first presidential candidate ever endorsed by the NRA. And of course, his politics did shift. He was an astute political strategist, and he understood by 1980 that he needed to support gun rights to keep his new right coalition together. And he was such an opponent of gun control when he was in office that even after he was the victim of an assassination attempt, he pushed for no new restrictive gun laws.
So tell me more about the origins of the National Rifle Association, and when did they become radicalized along Second Amendment lines?
The NRA was formed right after the Civil War by two former Union soldiers who were convinced that it was the poor marksmanship of Union soldiers that had allowed the war to go on so long. In the 1920s and 1930s, the NRA was a supporter of gun control, pushing states to adopt restrictive laws on concealed carry of firearms. In the 1960s and 70s, a series of assassinations like Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy and the race riots and the Black Panthers all led to a new wave of gun control laws. The NRA became divided between those who thought guns were primarily about hunting and recreation and those who thought guns were about personal protection against criminals in urban environments. Those hardliners ended up staging a coup at the annual membership meeting one year and replaced the entire leadership of the NRA with a group of hardliners who were committed to fighting gun control at all costs.
This was a schism that occurred at a point when the existing leadership of the NRA really wanted to move out west and focus on hunting.
That's right. I think of how different politics in America would be had the leaders of the NRA in the early 1970s carried through with their plan to retreat from political activity, move to Colorado Springs, and focus the organization on outdoors activities. That didn't happen, of course, and the NRA became committed to a very extreme view of the Second Amendment that really fought against any new gun control proposals under the theory that any new law was a slippery slope towards total civilian disarmament. And that view has really shaped gun rights in America ever since.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Winkler is a professor of law at UCLA and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. We spoke to him in 2012.
In the days following the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, there were plenty of calls for action. Democrat Gerald Connolly argued for an assault weapons ban, universal background checks, and closing gun show loopholes. Florida legislators are drafting a bill that would increase the minimum age for buying an assault rifle to 21 and impose a 3-day waiting period for purchases. And the president has been tweeting about regulations on bump stocks. But how do we know if these particular calls for action will do anything to prevent another mass shooting? We don't. And that's because of the dearth of research into gun violence. It was something President Obama noted in the speech he made following the shooting in San Bernardino, California.
We could further improve gun safety, just as with more research, we've reduced traffic fatalities enormously over the last 30 years. We do research when cars, food, medicine, even toys harm people so that we make them safer. And you know what? Research, science, those are good things. They work.
Todd Swillick is the acting host of The Takeaway. We spoke to him right after the shooting in San Bernardino, and I asked him to take us back to when all this started. It was in 1993 when the New England Journal of Medicine published a CDC-funded study that found, quote, keeping a gun in the home was strongly and independently associated with an increased risk of homicide.
Right. And this is the study, you know, when you hear it's more dangerous to have a gun in the home than it is to not have one. You hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. This is the study that showed that. That was 1993. And by 1995 and into 1996, the National Rifle Association started to lean on members of Congress to say, hey, this study that came out that was funded by the Centers for Disease Control, this is taxpayer money. They're advocating for gun control. We don't want you paying for this.
So that brings us to Representative Jay Dickey of Arkansas, who attached an amendment to a 1996 omnibus appropriations bill.
And it says none of the funds made available for injury prevention and control at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention may be used to advocate or promote gun control. That's all it said. And you say, well, that's not a ban. That doesn't tell people what to study. But here's the problem. Before they introduced this amendment, Brooke, they slashed the funding for the CDC by $2.4 million, the exact amount that had been used for this research in the Injury Prevention and Control Fund. And what message did that send? It said, you can do whatever research you want, but if you report your research and that research tacitly or directly advocates for gun control, you're going to be breaking the rules.
The issue seems to be that the NRA equated gun violence research with anti-gun political advocacy.
And Jay Dickey himself has talked about that, that back at this time, you have to remember how contentious the gun debate was. It's contentious now, but it was really in play. I mean, they had the assault weapons ban of 1994. That had just happened. The NRA thought that public health researchers, if they went into the medical journals or on the airwaves and said, my research shows that we would be safer if there were fewer guns available or if it were harder to buy a gun, yeah, they saw that as gun control, and maybe it was advocating for gun control. Nevertheless, this was the action that they leaned on members of Congress to take, and they took it.
So what kind of information don't we have, do you think, because of this ban?
Well, I think we don't know a lot about how guns hurt people in the real world. How more likely are you to injure someone else or injure yourself with a firearm if there's alcohol in the house? How is it connected to people's income? Are people with lower incomes at higher risk? I think there are great number of things that researchers would like to know. What is it that leads to the situations where a gun can hurt a person? It's hard to imagine any other area of human harm where 33,000 people die and 85,000 are injured, by the way, where the primary government research public health agency isn't permitted to study it.
And the same research ban was extended to the National Institutes of Health with almost the same language a few years ago. But Todd, after the shooting at that historic church in Charleston, South Carolina in July, an amendment was proposed that would have reversed the CDC research ban that you reported didn't go anywhere.
And I turned around and asked John Boehner, who was then the Speaker of the House, about it.
And he offered you this now famous reply.
Listen, the CDC is there to look at diseases that need to be dealt with to protect the public health. I'm sorry, but a gun is not a disease. And guns don't kill people. People do. And when people use weapons in a horrible way, we should condemn the actions of the individual and not blame the action on some weapon.
Well, an automobile is not a disease, and it kills the same number of people as guns every year. A bacteria is not a disease, for that matter. So I think from the epidemiologist perspective, that statement from the political sphere on Capitol Hill was really, really hard to take.
So let's talk about the man whose name is on that ban, Jay Dickey. He went through something of a conversion.
Yeah, Jay Dickey has come out. He's been talking to reporters to issue his apology. He basically said, look, this was a hot debate in the 90s. I thought that a government agency was advocating for gun control, and I did think that that was inappropriate. But I wish we hadn't gone as far. I wish they were doing the research. I wish we knew more.
Is it because he's no longer in office that he can take this position?
Almost certainly. I mean, I don't want to try to imagine or speculate what Jay Dickey would say if he were still an elected official. Who knows? But it's certainly easier for him now that he's no longer a member of Congress. Look, Brooke, this is about whether or not a public health agency can study a public health matter. And I think most people know that. But I had a conversation with a senior Republican aide here on Capitol Hill a few weeks ago and asked, are you going to undo this thing? You just have to strike 20 words and it's gone. And this Republican aide said, look, to you and me in this building, it's the Dickey Amendment. Outside of this building and outside the Beltway, that's called gun control, and that's how it'll be perceived. So the answer is no.
Forever?
Well, Brooke, who knows forever? You know, frankly, this is one of the smaller issues to the gun control lobby itself. I have asked them if they want to go after this ban at the CDC, and they say they do, but they consider this low-hanging fruit. They want the assault weapons ban. They want stricter background checks, and they're afraid that if they go for reversing the ban on a couple million dollars of research at the CDC, it'll be a small moral victory, but it'll be the only crumb they get.
I just can't help questioning the logic of gun control advocates who worry about this being the solitary crumb. It seems to me that research is something you can build an argument on.
For me, this isn't really about gun control at all. I mean, I used to be a healthcare reporter and a science reporter. And from that perspective, it's really for open and unrestricted research into the things that do hurt, harm, and injure Americans, whether it's a bacteria, a virus, domestic violence, an automobile, a knife, or a firearm. And carving off one of those things because it's politically charged is something I think that many of people who value science and research and what it can do for us find it inexcusable.
Todd, thank you very much.
Brooke, it's a pleasure.
Todd Zwillick is the acting host of The Takeaway. On this weekend's show, we'll look at the teens taking on the gun issue and delve into the question of how youth movements succeed or fail. And we'll unpack the conspiracy theory du jour, crisis actors. See you then.